This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. If you need any more information, head to FUBARradio.com.
Pitch Talk with Olivia Cox and Rachel Dan.
Well, hello, good afternoon, welcome each and every single one of you. It's like I'm reaching out to the nation. Well, I kind of am. This is Pitch Talk. I'm Rachel Downey. Olivia Cox, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Rachel. We've got a fun show coming up for you today. We've got two lovely guests in the studio. First up, we will have racing driver Jamie Chadwick in to talk all about winning as the youngest ever person of the British GT Championship and, of course, moving into F3. And then later on in the show, we'll also have the lovely Pixie Turner, food blogger and nutritionist.
It's a good name, Pixie.
It is.
It's good.
It's
a solid name.
It's a lovely name. It really rolls off the tongue.
It does.
It's a name for radio, some might say. But we also have all the sport news and headlines and, of course, a few discussion topics for you. So, sport headlines kicking off with, of course, Sunday's marathon. Britain's Mo Farah finished third in the London Marathon in a new British record. His only previous marathon attempt was in 2014, in which he finished eighth. But there has been a slight negative backlash, which we will discuss a little bit later on, in the wake of hundreds of runners on Sunday actually collapsing. Do changes need to be made? Were organisers really prepared?
It's a tough one because if someone, one of your loved ones, was the ones affected, obviously they're going to say things need to change. What do you think?
There were all sorts of stories coming through from the marathon, and the main point of concern is that there simply wasn't enough water. Now, obviously,
that's what Mo said as well, that we walked past it.
Well, exactly. This is the thing. If even in the men's elites, which are the first people to go through the water checkpoints, I mean, his gripe was actually that people were standing around chatting and trying to take photos rather than actively handing him the water. And I mean, he's come from a very different sort of running. He's not really used to this long distance, so perhaps things are different in the marathon to what he's used to. However, in the general public race, I think it is a real point of concern that between miles 8 and 10, they actually completely ran out of water.
I mean, that is ridiculous. That really is. So yes, things do. In that respect, there needs to be maybe something on standby that if the weather conditions do get extreme, that they can cater for that.
Well, it wasn't exactly a shock. The forecasters were predicting for about a week in advance that this was going to be the hottest Olympics on record. So a little bit of extra water on the course, water not only to drink but to cool the athletes down, because so many of the runners were actually suffering from heat exhaustion, which is a combination of dehydration but also their chronic over temperature.
When you ran the marathon, what was it like?
Thanks for just
that's right.
That.
Yeah. That's right. Miss Cox here. She ran the marathon. What was it like for you? Do you ever go without water? Do you feel you suffered?
I didn't. I was very well catered for in terms of water. The thing I will say, and I don't think this has been addressed enough, is that the London Marathon is staged in April. Now, it's not uncommon that we start having these warm days in April. We start having slightly fluky weather. And you've got to bear in mind that we are training. It's suggested that the average fun runner should maybe start training around October the year before. And that is going through the whole winter with rain, summer, sun, spells, everything.
Snow
is the word I was looking for there.
Yeah.
You get everything. And I can remember going out for training runs and I'd start the training run in the freezing cold and the snow. And I come back and it would still be doing that. So you adapt and you become really good at running in crappy weather conditions.
Yeah.
And then as soon as you get a warm day, even your kit, you're not wearing the same kit. I remember on the day of the marathon wearing shorts and T-shirt for the first time rather than like all-in-one lycra onesie jobbies.
Oh, what a sight for sore
eyes.
Behold.
But yeah, there definitely needs to be a good long, hard thing. Even there were firefighters in, I think, was it Essex? No, surely the marathon doesn't go through Essex. One of the fire stations, one of the fire stations actually got their fire hoses out and were trying to cool down athletes in that way because they
ran
out of
water. That's an embarrassment, though, that they can't cater for.
Well, exactly.
That's
really bad.
Yeah.
Very, very bad. We will be touching more on F1 and motorsport when we speak to Jamie. But just as our headline, Daniel Ricciardo of Red Bull is apparently considering other options unless Red Bull improves. Now, his co-driver, as it were, Max Verstappen has come under quite a lot of negative press, I think it's fair to say. Mm. And Daniel has in the past been slightly vocal about his co-teammates' style of driving. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be a really interesting season, seeing where the two drivers go. Red Bull have come out and said that there is absolutely no favouritism whatsoever. Don't know if I agree with that. Rachel, I mean, what do you think?
To be honest, everyone's pretty been complaining about Max Verstappen. I think Max Verstappen is a brilliant driver, definitely an F1 champion of the future. But right now, Daniel Ricciardo is definitely, in the next few seasons to come, will be that F1 champion that we'll be talking about. I think Max is just too careless at the moment. And yes, he's got that fearlessness of youth, but he's taking too many
risks. He's hot-headed.
Yes, and you get hot-headed, like you've seen people like, say, Lewis Hamilton loses his
cool. I was just going to say, does he remind you of Lewis from times gone
past? But Lewis wasn't that careless. You are putting other drivers' lives at risk with your careless actions. And I think,
well, I mean, the collision with Vettel just over a week ago was pretty telling.
And that's what you get, like when you get other races, say like races like Le Mans, and when you get the gentleman drivers, you get like your professional races, there's always art controversy because, you know, drivers that aren't professional do cause accidents, are dangerous. Now, I'm obviously not comparing that with Max Verstappen, but Max Verstappen, who incredible experience, he just at this moment, it's like he's enjoying taking these risks to the point. I don't know if he's trying to prove something.
Well, I guess that's almost his role. That's his driving style.
And he's such a good driver. He really, really is.
But I don't know how long he will be able to go without being penalised.
Yes, it's too much now. And he'll stay with Red Bull. I know we'll chat about this a bit later on with Daniel Ricciardo moving. Maybe he'll go to Mercedes. Hamilton, will he stay where he is? But that's all because of Red Bull and, you know, the conditions of the car not living up to expectations at the moment. But Max Verstappen, yeah, he is too reckless. He really is.
Yes.
Let's get him in the studio. Done.
Let's get him to do an opinion piece on the uncensored FUBAR Radio. So very quickly, before we move on to football, because there is lots of football news and lots of debate going on this week. In tennis, the Lawn Tennis Association wants to double the number of women tennis coaches in Britain to 1,600 in the next 5 years. And their ambitious goal has been backed by former Fed Cup captain Judy Murray.
Brilliant.
Now, that is a huge bit of news for women in sport, and for us here at FUBAR, we're very excited.
Yeah, we really, really are excited. And when we talk about tennis, now we can really start looking at this generation of female tennis players and get very, very excited with the names coming through and how well they are performing. So this is a brilliant story. It really is. And finally, I think in about 5 years' time, we are going to see sold out matches for the women's tennis, not just with the big names, but with, you know, the names slightly down the table. So, and again, we're going to talk about Maria Sharapova now, who, you know, has been in the top 10 at the top of her game for so long. She's now ranked number 42. She wants her day back in the glory.
But does she deserve her day back in the glory?
I would say no.
It's a really difficult one because she did come back and she has all the answers to every question about the doping allegations. And she's ever so sorry that her career was hiccuped in the way that it was. But I don't think she's sorry for the actual action. And I do think that it's probably sending a pretty poor message to other athletes and other tennis players and in the wider sporting arena.
Which does go tie very nicely because I completely agree. She was tested positive and she needs more repercussions than what she has. It's not going to happen now. It's done. It's passed. She's back. She's playing. But also secret files exposing evidence of widespread suspected match fixing at the top level of world tennis, including at Wimbledon, can be revealed. I think it comes out tomorrow. Mm. And again, it'll be so interesting if we're about to see something. And they say here Grand Slam winners have been tested positive, but it was never released. If this is just the tip of the iceberg, say with someone like Sharapova, if we're really over the next few days, next few weeks, when the files become public and, you know, we can and will be reporting on it here, what they found. It came to £20 million to fund this investigation. So, it'll be very interesting to see what they found and to go from there. Would you be surprised if it's widespread?
No.
Why?
I wouldn't, unfortunately. I think the trouble that we have with only testing athletes on certain days or taking an average score is that this can start to be manipulated, and a clever coach, mm-hmm. this is my real cynic talking, but a clever coach can sort this out. Thanks, this
keep
is
it
radio
coming,
goal.
Keep it coming.
A clever coach can really predict this, and it's performance enhancing drugs or any kind of drug. It shouldn't be anywhere near sport. And it is such a shame that it has become part of the sporting culture.
And it feels so antiquated that we're even talking about this and releasing evidence like this. But I think as well, with things like tennis, you probably don't suspect it. Obviously, we've had the athletics come through.
I think it's far more suspect. I think,
Max
typically
as well.
It typically comes hand in hand with the athletics. That's when most people think about it. But I think Sharapova really... her test results really shone a light.
Because she was a star of the game.
Huge fall from grace.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to rugby, and England captain Dylan Hartley has been ruled out of the summer tour of South Africa because of concussion. The Northampton hooker has not played since sustaining a head injury in last month's Six Nations loss to Ireland. Following specialist medical advice, the 32-year-old will now take an extended period of rest.
Not surprised.
No.
Not surprised at all. We've spoken about this. I know we've got to be quite quick with time, but we've spoken about this before. We've said that in quite a few years to come, you're going to see, you know, with the head injuries from this, but it's dementia.
I mean, they say that a game of professional rugby is similar to having a car crash. So, yeah, I mean, if there is any suspicions of concussion, of course.
He must be devastated, though.
He will be devastated. And the trouble is that, as with many professional athletes, when they are injured or any kind of handicap going on in their game, they will try and play it down because they want to be selected. This is their bread and butter.
Yeah.
And if they don't play, they don't earn. They don't get the wins. They don't gel with the boys, you know? It's a huge lifestyle.
Yeah, and you do feel as well, I'm not just saying this, but with rugby, playing for England, for your country, really does mean more.
In boxing, just before we move on to football, David Haye is staging his return fight against Tony Bellew at the O2 Arena on the 5th of May. Now, here's the former WBA World Heavyweight Championship, and this may well be his last big night in the ring. And interestingly, he's promised to ditch the trash talk for which he is known.
We'll believe that if it happens.
I know.
Although I think it's a very good point, Bellew has also said that boxing won't act on drug cheats until a fighter dies. Bellew believes...
Wow, punchy statement. Yeah,
that boxing chiefs must take a tougher stance on drug cheats. Yes.
I mean, this is going back to what we were just saying about tennis. The funny thing is that probably people, the athletes and the sports people in the games... they probably know exactly who's taking what.
And especially in boxing, it's widespread. This all comes to down because Mexican middleweight hero Saul Alvarez copped just a 6-month ban and no fine for 2 failed tests in the build-up to his now cancelled May the 5th rematch with Gennady Golovkin. Again, why not? Why has he not been banned?
Yeah.
Why? Because...
bad precedent.
Yeah, exactly. We are going to be very, very quick. Obviously, tonight, Liverpool-Roma, Champions League over at Anfield. Jurgen Klopp, well, first of all, let's have a look at the PFA Player of the Year, Mo Salah. He used to play for Roma, so it's going to be a very exciting game to see how Roma, and they'll be vying for Salah because we are looking at, they call him, is it the Egyptian King? He's one of the best players at the moment in the Premier League, one of the best signings from a foreign club for sure. Mo Salah with Liverpool there. Jurgen Klopp's also urged fans not to target the Roma team bus when it arrives at Anfield, because obviously the Liverpool bus, when it arrived on the first leg, you saw the
That was terrible. It's really sad, actually, that they even have to put out that warning.
It's ridiculous. So he's basically said, please show respect. This is Jürgen Klopp. Please show respect. This is such a fantastic football club and a football family known for fantastic atmospheres all over the world. We don't need to throw whatever at the bus of the Roma team. Ridiculous at having to say this. Very exciting game, though. I mean, Liverpool, over the last few years, has just become a force to be reckoned with. I think we're going to see them probably finishing maybe third or fourth in the league, so we're doing more Champions League next season. So that is the game tonight. Best of luck to Liverpool. I think it's foregone conclusion. That's because I'm a bit cocky sometimes. Another one, Phil Jagielka had an odd start to last night's match, carrying an AV1 robot onto the pitch. The Everton skipper made history against Newcastle by leading out the first virtual match day mascot, known as AV1, operated by 14-year-old Toffees fan Jack McGlidden. The wheelchair-bound lad used cameras to control it from his home.
Oh,
absolutely lovely.
Isn't that heartwarming?
Yeah.
That's so lovely.
Really lovely.
How did they decide who was going to do it? Competition?
No, because the young boy obviously in a wheelchair, and maybe to make history like this. I think it's brilliant to show that you can be a mascot, and you know, you don't need to be able-bodied or playing for your local team. If you've got a passion for your local club, passion for your team, then you're
that's
there
great.
Doing it.
I think
brilliant.
The message should be open it for all. That's brilliant.
I think that's a wonderful story. And last but not least, because we are going to have Jamie Chadwick in the studio, Juventus players emerged onto the pitch for Sunday's key Serie A match, and viewers' attention was drawn to a red mark on each of the players' cheeks, part of a campaign organised by Italian organisation We World, Onlus, the League and Players Association. The line of red lipstick was to help raise awareness of domestic violence in Italy. Amazing.
I really enjoy this. It feels like football is really, really backing some of the key, not just political, but society debates at the moment.
They've got the platform to do it.
It's so brilliant.
Yeah, it really, really is.
Well done, football.
Good work, football. I never thought you'd say that sentence.
I know. I'm shocked too.
How things are changing. We obviously have been talking about the Liverpool-Roma game going on this evening, second leg of the semi-finals, Champions League from Anfield. So we will get ourselves all ready and excited for Jamie Chadwick, and we'll leave you this.
Arsenal Stadium, please show the respect we have to show. So we are... this is such a fantastic football club, such an outstanding football family, known for fantastic atmospheres all over the world. So we don't need to throw whatever on the bus of the opponent team. If we can do what we did, creating an atmosphere even in front of the stadium, let's do it. I'm a big fan of that, but please show the respect they deserve. Everybody knows how nice, how wonderful Rome is. Not all the people know how wonderful Liverpool is, but we can show how wonderful the Liverpool people are, and the city, and the spirit of the club, and all that stuff. And we can show that in 20 minutes before the game, and then the whole world knows it. And I really think that all the people who are with LFC deserve that we show that face. I'm pretty sure Mo follows the whole season of Rome. He had a fantastic time there. He became the player there, which we have now here. The big credit to all the staff and the players at Rome, because they are all part of his development. So yes, it's strange, but in the end, we are all professionals. So and then it's going on. And the good thing is, in football, I'm pretty sure the Italian defenders are famous for not having friendly games. So I think Mo will feel pretty early in the game that they are not his teammates anymore, and then he can strike back in a football way. That's it.
So you go, Jürgen Klopp there. Pre-match talking about the Liverpool-Roma game this evening, Champions League semi-finals from Anfield. And I really want Liverpool to win. So there we go. That's my point. Olivia, are you enjoying the show so far?
Loving the show so far. And it's just taken a very colourful turn up, folks, because we have the lovely Jamie Chadwick in the studio. fresh from, I don't know, what have you been up to most recently, Jamie? You've got such a large bio.
Yeah, what haven't I been up to? Just been buzzing around racetracks, I guess, last couple of months, or since the season started. Yeah, been here, there and everywhere, and now I'm FUBAR Radio.
Winning in life, that's what you're doing right now, exactly. Being here. And the youngest winner of the British GT Championship. I met you, I think it was years ago, when I used to be pit lane reporter for Brick Car. And I remember you. First of all, how long have you been racing?
I can remember that. It was actually when I first came in. I remember us meeting. I think that was my first ever 24-hour race. I was 16 at that time. And I think we won that race. Wow. So I was, youngest ever 24-hour race winner or something. Before that, started in karting when I was about 11 years old, which is relatively late for actual racing drivers these days. Most out the womb and straight into a go-kart, but for me it wasn't quite meant to
be
like
driving.
That. Got into it a little bit later, but ever since it's been all go since, and racing in Formula 3 now.
You've had a quite miraculous, not miraculous, an amazing trajectory so far. What's it been like as a girl racing? Because you must come across so many male types, almost people maybe, especially because your name is quite a unisex name. Do you find that people assume you will be a boy?
100%. Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing I've had, actually, especially because as a racing driver, we have helmets on. We're fairly anonymous, especially when I was racing in the GT kind of cars. You're underneath a big cockpit, so no one really knows you. So especially having the name Jamie, most people just obviously, if you look at a timing sheet or a race result, they'd assume I'm a boy like 99% of the other guys that are racing. So for me, being a female in the sport means nothing. I guess I got into it when I was fairly young still, and I guess that meant that I didn't really have any sort of awareness of what was going on around me, any of the politics, anything like that. It was just something I did because I loved it. So, I guess ever since then and up until now, nothing's changed. I just focused on the job I want to do, and to be fair, the response and the welcome I've had in the sport's been fairly positive, and I guess that's encouraged me to continue doing it.
What would you say, highs and lows? What would be, let's start off with the lows of racing. Would it be the travel, the demands on you?
No, I'd say the lows are definitely, with motorsport, a lot of it is disappointment. You're not always winning, and there are a lot of things that can go wrong and quite often do go wrong. So, you can have mechanical issues with the car, you can have all sorts of things go wrong. And I guess when you put so much time, and it's the same with any sport, when you put so much time and effort into something, when it doesn't go right, it's one of the most heartbreaking things ever. But then on the back of that, the success and the feeling of that, I've played quite a lot of sport and no other sport for me compares to it. I think, when I've won races or championships, that feeling is honestly like no other.
You are obviously a very young driver, and of course you're the youngest winner, as Rachel said, of the British GT Championship. We were chatting just earlier about Max Verstappen racing for Red Bull in Formula One and how his age perhaps is making him make decisions that some other drivers might not. Have you ever had to struggle with your age sort of proving yourself?
A little bit. I think not long after we first met at the Silverstone race, the race before that actually was my first race in British GT. And although we went on to win that championship, I think I got excluded in the first race, and the second race I was involved in some contact, and it was just me being over exuberant, kind of a little bit like what Max is up to at the moment. Just not being used to being in that kind of environment. I was driving a £150,000 car, didn't mean anything to me at the age of 16, and I was hitting everything that was coming my way. So, definitely I learned a lot. And I think that's one of the things of motorsport. You just have to learn quick. It's not really a sport where you get many second opportunities. And if you look at Formula One, I can only really name Romain Grosjean and Danny Fiat of two drivers that have made mistakes and managed to recover from it. But other than that, you kind of make a mistake and you're gone, really, especially in your junior career. So it's just about learning as fast as possible. And you talk a little bit about what I enjoy the most about racing and what I don't. I think that pressure is something that when you're young can really get to you. And fortunately, I'm kind of starting to come through it as I'm getting a bit older and wiser through the sport. But definitely when I was younger, it got on top of me more.
What's the turning point been for your career, do you think? What race was it that did it, or sponsorship did it? What did it? What was that turning?
I think it's hard to pick one. I think definitely when we won that British GT Championship, that was a big point. I think that marked, for me, a point in my career where I knew that I was capable of doing something, and I had everything around me and behind me and a lot of support. And I think that was a big thing that sort of spurred me on to pursue it and really push then, well, the year after in single seaters. So yeah, I guess that was maybe a bit of a pivotal point, but it's difficult because each year gets harder and harder and it's never any easier the sort of longer you stay in it. So yeah. I wouldn't say it gets any easier, but definitely there have been sort of big turning points in my career.
And where would you like to see? What, is there a particular race that you would love to take part in, or a race track you'd love to go to? Where would you like to see your career go?
There are so many. I was asked about this the other day. Yeah, exactly. I think any young driver wants to compete at the pinnacle, so Formula One, you know, has to be where I've got my eyes, what I've got my eyes on. But there are so many cool one-off races and things. I'm really lucky. I'm fortunate enough. Aston Martin. I'm going to be reunited with them racing at the Nürburgring 24-hour next month. So that's a big sort of bucket list one to do. Yeah. And I'm really lucky to do that. But also sort of Le Mans 24-hour, Daytona 24-hour. There's so many races just beyond Formula One that, you know, I'd love to do one day.
24-hour racing. Now, talk us through that. How do you prepare for a 24-hour race?
It's a good question. I need to learn a bit more about it because I've got one coming up. They are really tough. I think the big thing about 24-hour races is being able to switch on and off on demand. I think the way that they say the best 24-hour drivers work is they eat, sleep, race, repeat literally. Yeah. And when I did that Silverstone 24-hour in 2015, I don't think I slept. I think I slept maybe a couple of hours maximum, but my adrenaline was so high, I wasn't really in any place to go to bed. Yeah. So I wanted to watch the race, see what was going on, and some of the more experienced drivers in the team were passed out for 6 hours, and I couldn't work out how they did it. But I think that's one of the most important things, because when you get in the car, you need to be as sharp as possible, and also just physically fitness. The cars get pretty hot and sweaty, so just training in the gym and keeping on top of everything.
What female race drivers inspire you? Who do you look up to or respect at the moment?
There are a few, definitely more past than maybe present. Unfortunately, there aren't many around at the moment. Obviously, Tatiana Calderon's done a really good job as her Sauber development driver, and her season's going to start soon, so I'm really excited to see how she gets on. But yeah, I think other than her, maybe in the past, obviously Susie Wolf did a good job, and Michelle Mouton in rallying, so slightly different avenue, did a really, really good job. But yeah, for me, I think it's not necessarily about there being a female role model. I think it's more about showing that it's possible to do it. So whether I do it or whether some other female does it, they need to show that it's possible to do it and make it to the top, because that's what will get more young girls involved.
Yeah. And was it unheard of as an 11-year-old going into karting as a girl? Did you have other girls there as well? Or?
None, I don't think. I think I was lucky. I got into it at a similar time to my brother. So So we kind of both went along together, and that's how I found my way. And I stayed with the same team when I was in karting, so I was in a very comfortable environment. But yeah, it's a scary thought. If I was just a young girl that liked motorsport, I wouldn't necessarily want to turn up to a kart track.
Daunting. No,
incredibly daunting, I can imagine. So going back to the 24 hours, or in fact any race that you do, is there a set routine that you have to do, or do you have to start thinking about your nutrition?
Yeah, definitely. I think one thing that's apparent with, if you look at any racing driver, they're all fairly slender. Weight is quite a big thing. It's a bit like jockeys. You've got to be at a certain weight. And I'm a little bit luckier because I'm shorter. It's easier for me to get to that weight than some of the boys that are 6 foot two. But yeah, I definitely have to be on top of my nutrition. And I'm the kind of person, what I eat makes a massive difference to the way I am. We're talking on the way here. I don't eat, I'm a completely different person.
Oh, I get a red mist.
Do you know what? I think we were talking about that too. Hanger, I think, is a thing. It should be a medical terminology.
Yeah. It's definitely real. I'm riddled with it.
Because especially being in and out of a car, I mean, that is a discipline. Doing a 24-hour race is something that most athletes will never experience, and
that's
it takes
so true.
A huge amount of self-discipline, I can imagine, especially as a younger person, to actually tell yourself, you know what, I don't need to do what I fancy doing, I need to do what I'm told.
Yeah, exactly. Especially if you look at sort of where I am in my life and what my peers are doing, or my friends that I went to school with, I have to be quite disciplined at, you know, doing what I think's right for me and eating what I think's right, or drinking what I think's right. And different things work for different people. I know people that race in 24-hour races and they eat junk food All day, and they're super, super fit, and they're just
those, annoying. Isn't
I was
it?
Just thinking, I'm going to take that small percentage,
very yeah. small,
but I'm going to assume that that can relate to me.
Yeah. Oh yeah, in a burger.
Can someone bring me some sweets?
Honestly, different things work for different people, and that's what I always say with fitness and nutrition: is it's not the same for everyone. And I know people that it's complete opposite with. If they touch a carb, then they put on a stone. So
I hear you.
Yeah, so it's both sides of the story, but. Yeah, it's just finding what works for the individual, and I've fortunately learned what works for me, and I kind of just work on sticking to that. I think meal prep is a big thing for race weekends for me in Formula 3, but also for the 24 hours as well. So, yeah, it's just, you know, working out what works for you, what makes your body tick the most, and sticking with it.
Yeah, it's very, very true.
I mean, yeah, we've been snacking on all sorts here in the studio. We did have carrot sticks for a little while. That was probably our healthiest.
That was a good attempt. I liked it. I respected it.
Jamie, you haven't always raced, or you possibly have raced at the same time, but you have also been quite big in hockey, I believe.
Yeah, I played before I got into motorsport, so none of my family, apart from my brother who later got into it, were involved in motorsport before me. So, yeah, it wasn't something that, like I said, I didn't sort of come out the womb and was like, I want to be a racing driver. I had no idea about it. So before that, I was fairly into sport. I really enjoyed playing football, hockey, whatever it was. And hockey became sort of something that I ended up doing at school. I was on scholarship at school to play hockey. And I then went on to have England trials that coincided, and I was just getting into motorsport at this time, and I coincided with the Ginetta Junior Scholarship. So the Ginetta Junior Championship is kind of a championship for young drivers to progress from car racing into kart racing. So at the age of 14, you can race a full spec car on a racetrack. Exactly. It's dangerous as well.
That's pretty scary.
Exactly.
I can't even drive a car on a road.
You've got these 14-year-old kids all going at it. It's mental. So, and I looked at that, and it was something that I really wanted to do. Mm. So I gave it a shot and prioritised the scholarship over the hockey, and yeah, I guess I've not ever looked back since, to be honest.
What do you think about, you know, they say the future is electric cars, obviously we've got Formula E and the success of Formula E, and there's a new electric car championship, I think, starting quite soon. What do you think about electric cars, and would you love to take part in something like Formula E?
I think I would love to take part in Formula E, not because necessarily it's electric and that side of it, but because the drivers and the teams in it are world class. So it is, from any racing driver's point of view, you want to compete against the best and being in some of the best machinery possible, and that's the direction Formula E is heading in. That's why I would like to race in Formula E, but at the same time, the electric side of it doesn't do much for me at the moment.
I was going to say, very diplomatically,
yeah,
so
exactly.
That was very, yeah, you have handled that very well. But they are, of course, releasing their latest model of car, which supposedly is going to be very much more exciting, have a lot more oomph in the engine, and trying to draw Formula E a little bit more in line with traditional racing.
I think, yeah, I like what they're doing with it. I really like the way they've gone about everything, the whole sort of fan engagement, the fact that they're getting sort of well-known celebrities involved with it. It's all really, really cool, and that's why I think for any racing driver it's attractive. But at the same time, there is no feeling like when you jump in a race car and you have to wear earplugs because you can hear the thing screaming. And the smell as well. That's one thing. Yeah. From the age of 11 up until now, every time I turn up to a racetrack, it's the smell it's like a drug. So probably is, to be honest. But
yeah. Wait a minute.
Yeah. Probably does something.
That well-known toxic. Yeah. Oh.
That's amazing.
So, Jamie, what is next on the horizon? I know you've spoken about some of your broader plans, but what have you got coming up next?
So next up, so I'm racing this weekend back in British F3. So we're one weekend down, but it's a long year, so that's the next race weekend I've got, and then obviously back with Aston for the Nürburgring 24 hour next month. So busy, but it wouldn't have it any other way.
That's fantastic. Brilliant.
Really,
well, very quick, actually, before you do go, what advice would you give young people coming through that want to get into racing? Because also I know, like, with sponsorship, it's a struggle. There's a lot that goes against you, I think, when you first start with racing. What advice would you give?
I think the thing I always preach, and it kind of is a little bit of what I've touched on, is just be yourself, be you. If you try and be someone else, if you try and be Lewis Hamilton, there already is a Lewis Hamilton, there already is, you know, a Jenson Button. You need to be yourself and the best version of yourself, because you're not going to do someone else better than they do them, if that makes sense. So be yourself, especially with regards to the sponsorship things. the experience I've had with sponsorship is people buy into me as a person, not necessarily what I offer as a brand. It's more as me personally, and I think that's what you've got to really think about, and especially if you're young coming through, just work hard, dream big, and see where you end up.
Yeah. Brilliant advice.
Wise woman.
I could do that advice.
Yeah, I really like
make
that.
Make a note of that.
I think I might just replay that to myself when I fall asleep. Yes. Thank you, Jamie.
That's amazing.
I'll copyright that.
Yeah, make sure you do.
I'll write
well,
it.
Thank you, Jamie, so much for coming in.
No
super
problem.
Super inspiring, and I think we can agree that we will be tracking your career with very much excitement over the next few months and years. So thank you so much, Jamie.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, we've got Pixie Turner in the studio, food blogger, biochemist, and nutritionist in just a few minutes' time.
Today I want to talk about the three foods that you should never eat. So pretty much every diet that you will come across will contain some sort of list of foods that you're allowed, foods that you're not allowed, foods that are good, foods that are bad, foods that are sins, foods that are sin-free. There's always a complete dichotomy of foods that are acceptable and foods that are unacceptable. These will vary considerably from diet to diet, but there's always some sort of rules attached to what you're allowed and not allowed to eat. Every time I see these lists, it makes me a little bit pissed off. It makes me angry. It gets me really riled up. And so I decided I would come up with my own version of the three foods that you're never supposed to eat. Number one, poisonous food. Sounds obvious, but there are plenty of natural things out there that are desperately trying to kill you. Things like poisonous mushrooms, for example. Please definitely avoid these because they will do you a lot of harm if you eat them. Number two, foods that you're allergic to. Especially if you have a life-threatening allergy, I would highly recommend that you avoid eating those foods because they can do some serious damage to your health. Number three, moldy or gone-off food. Now, I'm not talking about the expiry date on your food. I'm talking about, you know, you open the lid off a yogurt and it literally has a second life form growing on it. That is probably something that you should avoid. So in conclusion, these lists are generally bullshit and you should pretty much ignore all of them apart from this one, because this one's great and obviously satire, if that wasn't obvious enough.
Oh, brilliant.
Funny
brilliant.
Lady. Well, that was of course the lovely nutritionist, food blogger, extraordinarily beautiful Pixie Turner, who has just joined us in the studio.
Thank you, you're too kind.
How are you this fine day, Pixie?
I'm doing really well, thank you.
Good, and it's so great to have you on the show. First of all, food blogger, biochemist, nutritionist. What is a biochemist? Can we just begin there in case our viewers are unsure what it is?
It's a bit difficult to explain, to be honest, because so basically I did a 3-year degree in biochemistry because I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do with my life. And it involved looking at a lot of the sort of complex biochemical, so chemistry and biology, all the different pathways in the body and how they interact and how that relates to food to an extent.
Wow.
It's very scientific.
That's a lot.
I'm pretty blown away. So I think let's get all the way back to the beginning. Of course, you have got very many career achievements, but the main thing that we can glean from you is that you follow this plant-based diet. Can you explain what a plant-based diet is?
Yeah, so the main misconception is that it's the same thing as being vegan, which is absolutely not true. A plant-based diet is essentially one that focuses on plants as like the main component, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's only plants. So that can be anywhere from like between 2/3 to 100% plants. So it leaves a lot of leeway. It's very vague, and that's why I really like it, because it's very vague.
I had no idea about that. I literally did think it was vegan.
No,
yeah, most people do.
You've spoken out quite strongly against hopping on this vegan trend, which does seem to be, I don't know if it's a fad, but apparently there are more and more people turning vegan every year, every month. Of course, we have Veganuary in January. What's your take on this?
I think it depends on what people's intentions are. So if people are going in with very strong ethical views, very strong environmental views, then, you know, I'm not going to be the one to tell them not to do it. If, however, what I've seen is that people often use it as a way of masking an eating disorder or masking disordered eating, a way to maintain very strict rules about what they can and cannot eat. And I think if people are doing it for health reasons, then it's potentially misguided, because actually a vegan diet is not necessarily going to be healthier than any other way of eating. So for health reasons, I'm always a bit unsure of whether actually people should be doing it.
presumably yeah. as a nutritionist, you must get a lot of people coming to you asking how to lose weight, how to get in shape quickly. And there are all these cliches, of course, that exist. You know, your abs are made in the kitchen, or you can't out-train a bad diet. How far do you believe in that? Is health and fitness, is that really seeped in diet?
It's tricky because actually weight is a really terrible measure of health, and it's very crude and it's very simplistic. And it actually, as soon as you place the primary focus on weight, it's generally going to be very unsuccessful, whatever you're trying to achieve. Like, so putting the focus on weight makes weight loss really, really difficult. So I actually don't do any kind of weight management services. I don't do weight loss. What I do is improving people's health through health-promoting behaviours, whether that's eating more fruits and vegetables, whether that's moving their body in a way they enjoy, whether that's sleeping a bit more or reducing their stress. But I actually don't focus on weight at all because I find it makes people more stressed and actually less inclined to be healthy.
And I think as well, for me, it's about a lifestyle choice. You don't want someone to do this for a month and then go back
exactly.
to how they were before.
If you're having to put your life on hold to do it, it's not going to work. It's not going to be sustainable at all. You've got to live your life. You've got to enjoy life.
It's true, though.
So what about all these transformations that gyms and personal trainers promise? Is that a fad?
Well, what they don't show is the after. What they don't show is how that same person looks a year on, and that's where it's potentially misleading. So, you know, you can lose weight really easily in the short term, but making it long term and sustainable, that's where it basically becomes almost impossible for most of the population.
And do you think that's why there's been quite a backlash on certain celebrities, reality TV people that do these videos? You know, you get a photograph of them overweight, eating crisps on the beach, and then 6 weeks later, they're really slim. And then you see them a year down the line, and they're nothing like this very slim because it's been a crash diet. Do you think that's why there is beginning, I think, to be a bit of a backlash on that crash dieting, fake promises?
Yeah, absolutely. I think people are getting annoyed at how they're being misled by celebrities and buying into something that doesn't actually work.
Yeah. Does that annoy you? Because I know we'll talk about your book, so The Wellness Rebel. Does it annoy you when, you know, you see these people that aren't experts, that haven't, you know, got the degrees and put the hours in that you have, and then you see someone just come along and...
Oh, it annoys me so much. I can't even begin to tell you. Oh, I get so pissed off all these people. Because, you know, I've spent years studying. It's expensive to do a master's degree. And, you know, it's a serious dedication. And then there's these people who come along and say, oh, you know, I Googled something and I'm going to tell the world that I'm an expert on this and share it. I'm like, no, please don't, because it's probably wrong.
Yes, and we will see that.
So you've spoken quite openly about your own struggles with food and various things that you tried. When was it that you got that real light bulb moment of actually it's more moderation rather than cutting things out?
Yes, I was actually in Australia because I went travelling between my degrees, and I, as a lot of sort of wellness bloggers do, I made friends with wellness bloggers out there, and they were saying some really shocking things, like very much anti-science, anti-vaccination, and it really blew my mind. And there was that one moment where someone said, oh, I wouldn't dream of vaccinating my kids, and my brain just went, what the hell? I can't be associated with these people. I have a science degree. This is so wrong. This is potentially dangerous. Mm. And that was when I realized that actually this movement did carry a lot of risks and did carry some level of harm that I hadn't really thought about before.
So let's talk about your book, The Wellness Rebel. It's out now. And again, it does discuss the current state of healthy eating. And I like this here, we've got in the notes, and how you can enjoy eating well. And I think that is something I take that for granted, you know. I'm very much in the week. I don't think I do feed my body well. And then you can begin to look at food and it's quite a stressful thing. So I think it's great that it's about enjoying it.
Yeah, that's my primary goal, is to actually get people to enjoy food and really, really love it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think my favourite quote from you, Pixie, is I read in an interview with the Evening Standard, I had a raw vegan birthday cake and I was miserable. Now I'm taking on the clean eating brigade. I think that's great.
That's so refreshing.
Talk us through a raw vegan birthday cake. What on earth is in that?
Oh, sounds nutty.
Not much. To be honest, I think it was a combination of dates, nuts, coconut oil, coconut cream, cashews, because it was made predominantly of cashews with some... dates, some nuts, and not really much else. It just tasted like
the
dates and nuts.
Dates and nuts is coming up an awful lot. I'm not really feeling this.
I'm thinking claggy. No. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It literally
has
nothing
cake.
In it that a proper cake should have. Literally
but, you know,
nothing.
Surely that is actually unhealthy in itself, because that must have a dangerously high sugar level.
it's pretty much on the same level in terms of calories, in terms of fat, in terms of sugar as a regular chocolate cake or just a regular birthday cake, but with lots of guilt and shame added to it.
Yeah. And this is where I think these sorts of things get dangerous, because we're told there's such a thing as a good sugar and a good fat. And yes, some foods are better than the others. Some it's worth having that extra fat and that extra sugar content in order to get the other nutrients and fiber and minerals and vitamins. However, surely a sugar is a sugar.
Yeah, pretty much. And that's what makes me so angry about the whole refined sugar-free business, because biochemically, refined sugar and unrefined sugar are pretty much identical. There's no significant difference between them at the level that we eat them. Yeah, you know, if you eat 100 grams of maple syrup in a day, you do get a little bit of calcium and so on. But if you're eating 100 grams of maple syrup a day, you're probably eating a little bit too much sugar.
Yeah.
And actually, at the level that we eat sugar, whether it's caster sugar, whether it's coconut sugar, biochemically it makes absolutely no difference in your body. So you might as well go for the caster sugar, because it's cheaper and it works so much better in baking.
Good point. Okay,
so such a good point.
My big question that I really want answered, diet soft drinks. Obviously there is a huge negative furore surrounding aspartame and various other artificial sweeteners. Do diet soft drinks still give us the same insulin spike, and therefore are they basically doing the same thing as the full sugar version?
It's really hard to compare them, because there are pros and cons to both. Obviously, we know that sugar is directly linked. Well, sugar overconsumption is directly linked to, you know, dental risks. So, you know, tooth decay, and there's a potential link to things like type 2 diabetes as well. But with artificial sweeteners, obviously, they are safe. They are deemed to be safe. They've been studied extensively before they're allowed into the food system. But obviously, they haven't been in the food supply for as long. And so there are some potential emerging links between it, like disrupting your gut bacteria. And actually, it doesn't lead people to eat less overall. Actually, people who drink diet soft drinks versus regular ones still end up eating the same amount of food overall. And there's this idea that it might actually trick your body into wanting more sugar, because it gets that sweet taste without the actual calories.
And you're still getting that crash.
Yeah, not so much the crash, but even then, sugar crashes are a really complex thing in themselves. They're actually not as big and as obvious as people might think. A lot of it's psychological.
Mind blown. So if you were to, I mean, as a nutritionist, people will ask you, what should I eat?
Yes,
but
where do I start?
Your philosophy seems very much to be, eat what you want, or, you know, don't have bad foods, don't have cheap foods, think of food as something fun. So how do you structure your advice when you're telling someone what maybe it would be good to include?
I very much focus on inclusion rather than exclusion, and I also make sure I know what the person likes and dislikes. And it's very much focusing on, okay, which kind of vegetables do you really enjoy and how do you enjoy them? Let's work with that. And so, you know, if you really like roasted vegetables, let's work with that and eat lots of roasted vegetables. Like, you know, for example, I don't like boiled carrots. I find them extremely dull, but roast them and I think they're absolutely wonderful. So why should I eat boiled carrots when I don't really like them? Let's eat roasted ones instead, and kind of work with what people like and what they don't like. Get them to come sort of, I like using kind of like a basic template of different food groups that people should think about in each meal, without making it too prescriptive, without making it like a meal plan, and get them to focus on actually eating slowly, actually really savoring it, enjoying it. Because as soon as you remove the guilt and shame attached to certain foods and you enjoy them more, you naturally usually end up eating slightly less of them, because you really savor it and you really actually love it, and it's a more enjoyable experience.
Yeah. I mean, personally, if I come across something that's healthy, or for example, if I go to Ethos Foods and there's all the tabbouleh and hummus, and I mean, it's beautiful, I will chronically overeat compared to if I see something that
that's
I
so
consider
true,
a bit sinful, I will nibble.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll nibble for a while.
Yeah, a little bit.
But it will be smaller and I'll savour the flavour. Oh, that rhymes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think, you know, if you want cake, eat cake. If you really fancy, if you have a craving for a brownie, eat a brownie. Don't make a sweet potato brownie. It's not going to satisfy you. You're going to end up eating loads of it. Just have a brownie and just sit there and love it and enjoy it, and then just be really content afterwards.
Because that, I suppose, will stop binge eating afterwards. Because I know I've been there in the past where, you know, it's that punishing yourself. So then you just carry on eating.
Yeah, exactly. And the other reason people often binge is because they don't eat enough throughout the day. You tend, you know, you might eat like a tiny smoothie for breakfast, then a really tiny salad for lunch, and you get home in the evening and you wonder why you're literally eating the
ravenous
entire contents of the fridge. It's because you need to eat more food throughout the day. I mean, your body needs energy. You've got to feed it.
Okay, so there is this big idea. Well, so we used to have the big idea that you should punish yourself for bad foods and we should be very, very strict. And then it's come through that actually maybe having a cheap meal or a cheap ingredient, it doesn't mean you have to wipe out the whole day, because it's actually the day's worth of food rather than the meal's worth of food or that mouthful worth of food. Do you think that we need to go meal by meal, making sure we hit our macros and get all our complete proteins and our 22 amino acids? Or is it more like a basket that we're feeding and we just need to make sure we average out in a day?
Definitely average out, but not even in a day. Think more long term, think months or even, you know, yeah, think weeks or months. Because actually, if one day you don't get your five a day, it really doesn't matter, because what you're most likely happen is that the next day you'll have a bigger craving for fruits and vegetables.
Okay.
And even, you know, if you have a weekend where you're really hungover and you don't want anything other than pizza, it's literally not going to do you any harm whatsoever. So as long as, you know, overall, over the course of weeks and months, you are getting all the nutrients you need. It's not necessarily even on a day-by-day basis. We need to think more long-term. We need to think more broadly.
That's pretty reassuring.
And so reassuring.
Speaking of shattering my myths in the corner, can you just talk us through the video that we played, or the soundtrack we played as you were coming into the studio was one of your own podcast videos, YouTube. What myths are you shattering there? What is it you're trying to achieve through those?
I don't think there is any one food that people need to avoid for good health. I think this idea that there are foods that people immediately reach towards cutting things out from their diet to get healthier, and I think that's completely the wrong attitude. And no matter which kind of diet you look at, which kind of cult group you look to, they always have specific rules about foods that you can and you can't have. And I wanted to kind of shut that down and say, you know, all foods are okay. All foods can be on the table. It's a matter of moderation. Yes, some foods may be more than others, but that's not the same as eliminating them. That's not the same as cutting them out entirely. And actually, I think that the healthiest diet is the one that includes the widest variety of things, including things that you really love. And so with that video, I was kind of parodying all these ridiculous like crash diets and things, which will say, oh, you know, here's a list of foods you can and can't eat, because I don't think that's really how food should be looked at, as a list of rules of things you can and can't do.
Do you know what? So refreshing.
So true.
Yeah.
And I think, sadly, that's what we've got time for, picking Pixie's brains, but
I like that a lot.
Thank you so much, Pixie. So everything in moderation and a little bit of what you fancy does you good.
Exactly.
Pixie, your book, The Wellness Rebel, is out now. So guys, do make sure you get it. Pixie, yes, thank you again.
Yes, please buy my book. Thank you.
Yes, and I want to go and have cake. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Fubar Radio presents
Show with Johanna James.
Huge welcome, Arabella Neal. Welcome.
Yeah. With a clap.
Hello. It's a wonderfully bonkers, insane play that it's set in a club toilet.
I am so intrigued.
I know.
Because I always wonder what goes down there.
Oh,
yeah.
You don't even want to know, but you want to know, but you don't want to know.
Because exactly. Ladies go together.
We go together. I mean, we literally go together. We'll sit and pee at the same time.
In the cubicles.
Yeah.
You stand in the cubicle together.
Yeah, because you're continuing your talk. You just drop your knickers, have a wee, and then you swap places.
Yeah, absolutely.
Shut up! No way!
Well, it's not that weird. You guys get your Johnsons out next to each other.
Yeah, but I don't tell my mate to shake it, do I?
Every Friday.
Macaroon Show with Johanna James.
From 4 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
Wow, I don't know how to follow that.
These adverts go out live, right?
Oh, yeah.
Everyone heard that. Everyone heard talking about weeing in the middle of a sports show.
Wow.
Well, you know, shake it up. I mean, everything in moderation.
Shake it up, literally.
Oh, wow. That was Pixie Turner, who is a food blogger, biochemist and nutritionist. And she has a published book, which is an extraordinary number of achievements. So that moves swiftly onto our fitness segment. And one of the big things coming out this week is that there is a new study which suggests that an intense 3-minute workout is in fact the best way to get back on the fitness wagon. So this is rubbishing some of the NHS guidelines that have told us to do a 30-minute workout 5 times a day. A Melbourne-based physiotherapist has said all we need is 180 seconds per day. Rachel, thoughts?
I mean,
Rachel here, who regularly goes for like 14-kilometer-mile runs.
14 million billion. Do you know what? For a start, I like this because I think those people that are maybe a little bit, I don't know, scared's the right word to work out, but you feel like, oh, I've had months or years not working out. I can't do it. I can't go and do an hour's worth of a workout. It makes it more approachable that you can
do
this.
I mean, they do say that the hardest thing is getting your kit on and getting out the door, don't they?
Yeah, and it is. And again, psychologically.
Absolutely.
Psychological. I've learned from you, and I actually, for my own workouts, when I do these hits, so when I do a couple of minutes of kind of really fast runs, really, really fast, it actually, it's better for me. I feel like I'm fitter for that than doing like a very long, boring run.
Well, the thing is, I think the idea of interval training really is, it's very, very set in science. And it increases your metabolism and it keeps your body burning fat for up to 24 hours after you've finished exercise. But I think the question is whether or not 3 minutes is really long enough even to...
They don't mean
hit
that's
those
it,
intervals.
Though, do they? Like,
they do. And actually, the real reason that they suggested this is that it might help people to aim for longer. So it's the same as your idea in that, you know, start small, get bigger.
I like how you said that. Same as my idea. So thank you very much.
World Health Organization being led by Rachel Downey.
Can you imagine?
I think there's a huge amount of enjoyment, though. And I think if you are aiming to get back into fitness, if you're going to be doing something you love or something that gives you that immediate reward, that gratification, it's much easier to keep it going.
Yeah, it really is. And do you know what? I think the key from today's show is... it's having fun with it. The minute you put that pressure, gotta lose weight, and that's with food, exercise, gotta count your calories. It makes it really, it just loses. It's a bore. It becomes more of a job.
It does. It's something that you absolutely have to do. I think, yes and no to that 3 minute idea.
Yeah.
Moving on, another story that has come through this week is that there is a fear of judgment that's holding women back from exercise and sport. And this is according to a new campaign which addresses the anxieties that prevent 3 in 5 Australian women from being active. Now, 3 in 5, that is a huge number. That's if you consider you, me and Abby would be the inactive out of 5. That's terrible. That's a shocking statistic. I would be interested to see the comparison with men.
I would. And I don't know... fear of judgment. But judgment from who? I mean, is it because gyms are intimidating and you feel that you're going to get judged by the men
it
or
is.
Fit people?
According
women?
To this, so the Australian campaign, This Girl Can, found that 52% of women worry about being judged whilst exercising. And for 40% of this was a feeling of embarrassment or intimidation so strong that they think it's unlikely that they will start at all.
I don't know.
I think one of the big other issues that comes through on this is women going through children, childbirth, pregnancy. It makes it much more difficult to get back into sport because something like sport is muscle memory. And once you stop doing it, any athlete who's had a break from exercising, from fitness, from training will tell you it is so much harder to get back in than it is to drop it.
And do you think it's an age thing maybe? If you are a little bit older and, you know, your gym's for very young people wearing like lycra little tops, and that again, you might feel a bit like, well, I can't work out because you're going to look at me with this.
It probably is very regional, this, because depending on the kind of gym you're going to will really depend on the type of people. I mean, if you're going to your local gym and it's very rough and ready, salt of the earth, lovely people who train hard and you're encouraged to train hard, that's great.
Yeah.
If you go to a gym where you feel like you need to have trained hard in order to get through the door... because everyone else looks like a supermodel.
Full face of makeup, I know.
Then
that
was quite difficult. Yeah. But I do think there's a huge gender issue here, and we unfortunately don't really have much time to discuss it. But there are stories coming through from this Girl Can ambassadors. So Lisa Schulp, who is a surfer, said that she found that there was a lot of testosterone in the water. You'd see the blokes going for it, so you'd hang back. And this actually meant that she started off on a surf mat, which were these blow-up things that they sat around the water in the waves. They'd surf just the same, but you can't stand up. So it was almost like a degradation because they felt that the real waves, the surfing, was the men's territory.
Do you know what? Next week's show, let's really do a big section on the men's, women's.
Let's scratch that surface.
Yeah, can we? I think this is really interesting.
Scratch that itch.
Yeah, I like it. No, I think this is a really, really interesting discussion to have.
It is. Thank you. And just in case anyone didn't know, when I referred to Abby, it is producer Abby.
Yes, producer Abby.
Who's sat in the corner. Hi, Abby.
Hi.
She can't say hi. She says hi. That's pretty much all we've got time for. Rachel, what have you got to add?
Do you know, the one thing I've learned from this show, and which we will cover, I definitely want to focus on this for next week, is it is that whole having fun with exercise, food, and it's this barrier. I think, I don't know, I think we've got a long way to go. And
we
assumed we didn't.
Well, I think as women and as girls, sport, being active is really not as, it doesn't come in our daily lifestyle as much as it does for boys. So you look at boys when you're growing up, look at your nephews and your nieces, they all are outside playing tag, playing it.
But is that because as well, oh, this is good. Say with a lot of young boys growing up, they're playing football because they're looking at their stars, the people like Neymar and Lionel Messi, people they really idolise, and posters on the wall. Girls don't really do that.
No. And I think that's probably failing of our...
We need more stars in sport, maybe.
We do.
Female stars.
We need to start respecting our female teams and our female athletes in the same way as we respect their male counterparts, because it is not men and then women. It is men and women on an equal footing. And that is what we need to promote for our young people.
I'm just so excited by this. Next week, I want to talk about this, men and women, how we can, you know, look at this, really kind of scratch the surface. And also, let's focus on female stars in sport.
Let's.
And really celebrate it. That's the end of the show. Olivia Cox, you've been fantastic.
Thanks.
You really have. It's been very interesting.
So have you, Rachel Downey.
Thank you very much, my darling. We will see you next Tuesday, 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. on Pitch Talk. Have a wonderful week. Bye.
Bye.
This past hour, you've been listening to Pitch Talk with Rachel Downey and Olivia Cox. To listen again, simply go to foobarradio.com or our app, where this episode and all past episodes are free to stream or download. Send all questions, comments or queries to pitch@foobarradio.com or tweet @foobarradio.